Scotland's government making war on free speech, and Harry Potter author lobbing a grenade back at the state. Plus, how Russia is digging its own grave. Welcome to Constable Confidential. I'm Simon Constable, and joining us today is Robin Horsfall. He's a former paratrooper and an SAS operative and many other things. Thanks for joining us, Robin.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about Scotland and free speech, or lack thereof. What happened?
Well, the British public have gone to sleep over the last decade thinking that these particular issues only apply to a small number of people, so they don't apply to them. And there's some element of truth in that. But what's happened is the Scottish government and the English government and the Irish government have started to introduce laws supposedly to protect certain categories of people. And in doing so, they're actually oppressing the majority of the population. They're creating a protected species, and that those people can now abuse these laws, which are designed apparently to prevent people from causing alarm and fear and for stirring up and inciting hatred, from actually being able to think for themselves, to be able to speak for themselves. And so essentially what it does is it shuts everybody up, because it's not whether you're found guilty or not that's the important factor. It's the process that closes you down. It's the process of having policemen come around and act as thought police and question your thinking. It's because there are two main categories. There's the hate crime category, which I hate the word use of hate anyway, because it turns what is an action into a motivation as a crime. And which is fairly obvious. You know, somebody can be violently abusive to somebody, put them in fear of their personal safety, abuse them, deny them their rights and equality. And that's, you know, we can those things most people support. But the other side of it is this non-criminal hate crime, where you haven't done anything wrong, but they don't like the way you think, or you've offended somebody, and the onus is on you to prove that you haven't thought in a bad way about that other person. And that's absolutely disgraceful. It's Orwellian, it's wrong, it shouldn't be happening, but it's crept in to the Scottish Parliament. And I tell you now that as soon as Keir Starmer gets in the next election, they'll be trying to raise the level that already exists in the UK to the Scottish level. And it's wrong. I mean, it's already falling to pieces in Scotland. About 8,000 complaints already, closed 29 police stations and opened 430 offices so people can make these complaints. It's farcical. And it's about time the British people got up and voted these people out and started doing something about it, rather than hoping that the people they vote in will actually do what they're supposed to do, because they're not. We need change. We need change, and we need the British people, the majority of the British people, to start standing up and voting and doing something about this.
You said something fascinating in a LinkedIn post, and you have great analysis here. It says, it's less than a year since an autistic child was arrested in Manchester for hate speech when she remarked that a female officer looked like her lesbian granny. That is a ridiculous thing to arrest someone who probably didn't know that what they were saying was insulting or rude. And it certainly doesn't sound like, from your description, that that is a hate crime. That is maybe a faux pas socially. I don't know, at most, but we've all made faux pas socially. And if you haven't been trying hard enough. I should just point to everyone, Hamza Youssef is the First Minister of Scotland. It's a delegated authority. This is for our American audience. And this idea of hate speech is really becoming ridiculous now. There are rumors, and according to your piece, of comedians being targeted by the police for hate humor that might offend someone or cause them anxiety. And that has already arisen. And that makes you wonder what the Edinburgh Festival, which is one of the biggest festivals in the world, I think it's in the top three there, along with the World Cup and the Olympics. Does any comedian want to go there? I mean, the whole thing about comedy is it's often quite insulting. Doesn't mean it's not funny, but it's always someone is the butt of the joke, and that is just the way it is. What do you think happens next? Do you think the Scottish people who voted in this government repeatedly, this Scottish National Government, what do you think they're going to be doing? Are they going to stick with their guns and say, okay, this is right, we don't want free speech in Scotland? You seem to be alluding to that across the whole country. Is this it? Basically, free speech gone?
Well, hold on to that one a minute, because what a lot of people don't understand is that there are two categories to this hate crime legislation. The first one is the hate crime, which is fairly obvious when somebody is attacking or abusing or insulting you and intimidating you because of your race, color, gender, difference of some degree, and making you fearful. Now, we all pretty much understand, and we've all come across people that can behave like that. And, you know, and that's the rod that they use to keep us in place and to agree with this legislation. But on the other side, there's the non-criminal hate incident. The non-criminal hate incident means that there is no crime, but the police come round and record an incident with your name on it because they want to check on your thinking, check on what you said. Now, you might not have done anything wrong, but at some point in time, your name is now linked on a computer, which will show in an enhanced criminal records check that a non-criminal hate incident is associated with your name. And I'm actually of the opinion now that it wouldn't be a bad thing to have on my gravestone, Robin Horsfall died with 600 non-criminal hate crime incidents to his name, because I think it's something that people should start being proud of, because voicing your opinion, upsetting people, is actually your right in the law. You know, the law that says you have the right to freedom of expression says that also you have the right to convey opinions and ideas which offend, shock, or disturb. So which one is it? You can't upset somebody, or you can upset somebody. So this new legislation is farcical and it's wrong. Now, back to your question, you know, what are the Scottish people going to do? Now, the Scottish people have been, dominated by the Scottish National Party, or the Scottish National Socialist Party. And they actually have used anti-English rhetoric over the last generation to manage to popularize their organization and to get votes. Now, most Scottish people couldn't give a damn one way or the other. They're just getting on with their lives. The moderate moral majority, stuck in the middle, worrying about paying their bills, paying off their debt, their mortgage, their kids, getting them to school, getting to work, paying for the increased taxes on the car and everything else like that. And so they're allowing these extremist groups, whether they be left or right, they all end up in pretty much the same place, dominating the political agenda. And they've crept these laws in. And these laws are being introduced not to protect people that have differences. They're being introduced to stop people challenging the government, to stop people challenging the leadership, so that people in government can turn around and go, I'm offended. You've upset me. You've misgendered me. You've used the wrong pronoun to me, and I'm going to send the police round and have you stopped. Now, whether it gets to court or not doesn't matter. The process itself will shut you up eventually, because you don't want these guys knocking on your door, asking you questions every time you open your mouth.
Now, you mentioned the anti-English sentiment. I lived in Scotland for a while in two periods, once when I was at college and once more recently for a few years. And one of the things that was very obvious to me the second time was how much hatred was being fomented in Scotland against people who were born in England, as I was, and as my wife was also. And that seems to be basically open season. If you're Scottish and you want to abuse someone verbally of being English, and if you have that hate speech directed at you, that isn't a problem to the police. I do not believe, I could be wrong, but I do not believe there is a category of hate crime for hate against English people if you're in Scotland, which makes a mockery in many ways of what they're trying to do to stop hate. They're actually really basically saying, yes, if you're in our group, we don't want you being hated. But if you're not, well, we don't really care. And that will turn out badly for everybody, I believe. I want to go on next because this story keeps going. J.K. Rowling was already in trouble for upsetting some transgender people by the way she worded things. And she has basically lobbed an oral grenade, not a real grenade, but an oral grenade back at the state saying, the police should arrest me for my comments on trans people. Take it from there. What do you think?
Well, I'm actually really glad that somebody like J.K. Rowling has done that. I would also like to see Billy Connolly come out and say something as well, you know, because he's not shy of coming forward. And the reason that we need people like them to come out and voice their opinions so strongly and eloquently is that they have the money. They're not going to be dominated by having to worry about paying a solicitor in court, by having people knocking on their doors. They can cope with that kind of pressure. And they're not going to worry about somebody giving them a job and it being on their enhanced criminal records checks. So it's very, very important that people like them come out and speak openly against this legislation and keep speaking about it. It's no good coming out this week and then getting on with something else next week. There's got to be a process that keeps the pressure on because they'll hope that you'll get tired and go away. They play those games as well. Have we forgotten about Nicola Sturgeon already? Most people have. They've moved on. And yet nothing has actually happened about the £600,000 that still has to be traced while under her leadership. You know, and this is what people do because the majority, the vast majority of the hardworking, decent people in Britain, whether it be Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland or England, are busy getting on with their lives. And they can't believe that people that have been elected into positions of power are daft enough to bring this kind of legislation in. But it gets in because the dafties, as the jocks call them, have got into power because people haven't paid attention to what's going on.
And I guess now is the time to realize that, yes, some people, the people who've been elected, are daft enough to try and introduce laws that really seem absurd. And of course, nobody in their right mind gets up in the morning and saying, who can I go hate on and insult this morning? And my view is you should only insult your best friends because they're the ones who understand you and you understand them. And that makes things a little bit different. Let's move on now to Russia. You've written a fantastic analysis of what's going on in Russia and the bleak future Russia has no matter what happens with this war. Explain, please.
Well, in the last 2 years, they've gone from a very, very wealthy country earning huge amounts of money, which they can raising the levels of raising the quality of life for the people of Russia to in 2 years destroying that. Their economy is plunging. They have spent a national wealth fund keeping the war going. Their brightest, youngest, most innovative and most educated people ran from the country. Almost 750,000 of them in the first few months left the country because they could. They had a problem with reproduction and replacing their population before the war started. People weren't having as many babies in Russia. And the demographic of the old people was getting bigger while the demographic of the young people was getting smaller, which is going to create a problem for the future. Now, they've created a problem where they've got mass emigration. They've got mass deaths in their war. They've lost over 450,000 men killed or wounded in the first 2 years of this war. And they're losing an average of 800 to 1,000 a day, every day. And even if they were to in some way achieve some kind of victory in this war with Ukraine, it's going to take them at least a generation to recover financially, but also to rebuild their population. They are going to have to immigrate. They're going to have to import men to produce children for them. Now, that's going to be very unpopular with the Russian right wing. So where are they going to go with that? It's very, very difficult to see how Russia has an actual future. It's going to start, it's already falling apart. The only thing holding it together at the moment is the dominance of Putin and his dominance over the public message, over the media system. It's got to crumble at some point.
Those figures you mentioned about the deaths per day on the Russian side, if you go back to things like the Battle of the Somme, my understanding is it was 100,000 a month in the First World War, but that was a world war. This is just a war between two countries. So we're talking about a third of that. If it's up to 1,000 a day over 30 days, you get to 30,000. That's an incredible amount. And it really hasn't happened that way in many, many wars since the First World War. The death toll seem to have been quite a lot lower. Do you think Ukraine is going to be able to survive this continued onslaught? It seems that Putin and his generals don't really care about the deaths of their soldiers or the enemy, of course. But do you think they're going to be able to survive this?
I think Ukraine can actually win this war. I think they're already winning it, in spite of some of the messages that seem to come across from our own media that do Putin's propaganda work for him. They stopped him in the first few days from taking Kyiv. They stopped the operation. They defeated him. He parked his army in February down a single road and had, if Ukraine had had air superiority at that time, his whole 100,000 people would have been smashed in something close to the Falaise Gap. It would have been a massacre. Ukraine has technical superiority. It has sunk more than a third of the Russian Navy in the Black Sea. Russians can no longer operate their Navy in the Black Sea. And Ukraine doesn't even have a Navy. It has marine drones. They achieved air parity. So Russian pilots cannot fly over Ukraine with impunity. If they do, they get shot down by the surface-to-air missiles. They're getting attacked on the ground in their airports. Only this week, only 2 days ago, airports 1,000 kilometers into Russia were hit with drones, and six advanced jets were destroyed on the ground. Russia's on the back foot. They're taking small tactical pieces of land at the moment. At enormous cost to men and materiel in Donbass. But they're not doing much else. And we're talking about a village, a field. That's all they're getting for it. In the meantime, behind the lines, their economy is crumbling. The sanctions are starting to bite. They cannot export their oil because they do not have enough ships to export it. They cannot ship out their gas because the Nord Stream has been closed down and there are no pipelines to India and China. And the Indians and the Chinese have had enough. You know, they're buying at a discount anyway. So it was at bargain basement prices. But they've got no more storage facilities left for it anyway. So what's Russia going to do? Their oil terminals and their petrochemical refineries are being struck in the west of Russia. That means that their economy, their oil and gas income is down about 14%, which is huge amounts of money. You're talking about hundreds of millions every single day. And yet, what's so disappointing is the Western media don't highlight these particular points constantly and tell everybody. And of course, we've got the problem with the grand old party, the Republican Party in America, who have given some hope and confidence to Vladimir Putin that he can keep his war going until, hopefully for them, Trump gets back into power, which would be a disaster for the whole Western world.
The words coming out of the Republican Party in the US seem to be like the know-nothings during the early parts of the First World War, which is, we don't want to get entangled in another war abroad. Now, this hasn't stopped America getting entangled in a lot of wars anyway. It's very selective on what's going on here. Do you think that a lot of that bluster that we've got from the right wing is just to get people to realize that this is costing money and that really they don't want Russia to win? Or is it that they don't care? What do you think? That's a tough question, I know.
They don't care. They don't care, and not only do they not care, they don't know. In fact, most of them wouldn't be able to point out Ukraine on a map. Some of them would be lucky to point out Canada on a map. That's how naive they are outside of their own world. The only thing that's important to many of these people that run for Congress is that they want power, and they're prepared to say and do anything in order to get it. And in spite of how strangely ridiculous it is to the rest of the world, they still want a criminal who has been indicted for 61 crimes, okay, not convicted, who has been found guilty of sexually assaulting a woman, who has got nothing about him that is manly or decent or humane, and they still want to keep voting that person in to a position of power. It's strange and peculiar to most of us. Why would you want to do that? You want somebody in charge who represents decency and fairness and honor. It's a strange and peculiar world. And I swear that the older I get, the madder it seems to be.
Well, it does seem pretty mad right now. One of the things I saw in the news recently was very senior NATO official said that Europe wasn't ready and could not repel a Russian invasion. What are your thoughts on that? I know that a lot of the countries in Europe have started to bulk up. Germany, not so much, which is should be doing a lot more and hasn't really been doing it. It hasn't reached its 2% target since God was a boy. But I think that basically 1990 was when they fulfilled their 2% of GDP spending. But do you think it's possible for Europe to bulk up fast enough, or is this a real threat?
Oh, it's definitely a real threat. 2 years ago, I wrote a piece which went down very well, saying that NATO had got fat and flabby. It had got lazy. It had cut back and cut back and cut back. And, there was some fairness in the statements that, most of the people, with the exception of the USA, that the other NATO countries weren't doing their fair share. And even those that could claim that they were paying 2% of GDP were playing accountancy tricks with it. I mean, the British themselves were putting their pension payments for soldiers, former soldiers, through on that 2% GDP. In fact, I had a real issue with Ben Wallace, who was Secretary of State for Defense at the time, when he came out and said that we're investing more money in the military than ever before, except in manpower. Now, there's nothing like the war in Ukraine to show how important that manpower is and still is. And yet the British Army is still talking about cutting back the numbers of people in the armed forces. And Ukraine shows quite clearly that even with all the technology, even with the new drone war, you've still got those men in the trenches. You've still got those infantry in the armored vehicles. You've still got the tank drivers. We haven't got enough people in the British Army now to defend Dover. That's how small we are. We could put the whole of the British armed regular forces in three banks of Twickenham Stadium. That's how many it is, 68,000. And only about 25 to 30,000 of those are T-farms. That's infantry, armor, and artillery. So that's what we've got.
That's the sharp end of a battle unit, then, the people up there at the front with the knives on the top of their rifles and all the rest of it. That's very worrying. And to put this in perspective for our American listeners, the British Army is far, far, far smaller than the U.S. Marine Corps, and that is really will be really quite shocking for many Americans, because the U.S. Marines are seen as the smallest and possibly, in many ways, most maligned unit across the U.S. because in the military purposes, because you've got the Army, which is very big, you've got the U.S. Navy, which is very big and vastly superior to any other navy in the world, and then you've got the Air Force, which is big too, and then the Marines are really quite tiny in comparison to those others, but Britain makes tiny even smaller And that's something I think that the British government and the European government should think about, because none of us want to see Russian tanks rolling through our fields, definitely not here in France. Let's move on to your book, which was called Fighting Scared. And it's a story of your life. And we talked about this a few days ago, and I didn't realize where the title Fighting Scared was. My assumption was that anyone who was fighting in a war and being shot at or had the potential to be shot at would be scared. And it was the real heroes who were scared and who did it anyway. And you said there's actually more to this story than that. Please explain it to us.
Well, I wrote the book. It took me 6 years to write Fighting Scared. And when I first started writing it, my wife was my editor. And I wrote the first few chapters, and she read them through, and she came back to me and said, excuse the expletive, but she said this. I said, well, what's wrong with it? And she said, you've written it like a military report. It's a series of facts and dates and what happened. He said, where's the color? Where's the life? Where's the feeling? Where's the emotion? And so she counseled me into releasing that into the story and talking about my feelings and talking about my emotions and the process of going from a boy to becoming a man and going through boy soldiers at the age of 15, parachute regiment at 17, SAS at 21, mercenary, bodyguard, blah, blah, blah. And when it had come to some kind of conclusion, we had to find a title for it. And she said, well, what have you called it at the moment? I said, well, at the moment, I said, it's just a temporary title, but it's called Can't Crack Me, I'm a Rubber Duck, and which is still in one of the chapters. But she said, well, what's it about? I said, well, in real terms, I said, it's about a young lad who's involved with an awful lot of conflict, an awful lot of fighting. And she said, well, why? And I said, well, when I was 19, I was a private soldier in Cyprus, and I've never been much of a drinker. And I went to bed early in a big 20-man room. And two guys came in drunk. And for no reason other than the fact that they were drunk, decided to beat me up. And they nearly beat me to death. And I was intubated on the way to hospital. I spent 10 days with the bruising and it's being so severe that I couldn't open my eyes. I had a fractured jaw, a dislocated jaw, broken fingers, broken ribs. I'd been attacked with a razor, and it took me a long time to recover. And after that, I psychologically changed. I was a pretty standard young soldier, getting on with life and all its difficulties. But after that, I got called Bad Bob, because if anybody was looking for trouble, I was going to give it to them. I didn't go out beating people up or attacking people, but there was always in a garrison town somebody looking for trouble, and I was quite happy to give it to them first. And so I was fighting all the time. And she said, why were you fighting? I said, because I was so scared of being hurt like that ever again. It was never going to happen. And she calmed me down. I met her when I was 21 and we're still together now, 46 years later. And she calmed me down and she gave me back my humanity. And in some ways, but that person is still there, but there's a polish over the top of it.
And I should remind everybody listening to this is that is a great story and very, very revealing of your strength of character to say that and what happened to you. You were also part of the team that helped save the hostages in the Iranian embassy in 1990, which was really the first time, 1980. That was really the first time that the British and the world got to see the SAS in action on TV, even if we couldn't identify who was who. You're a real hero and a real credit to Britain. Thank you very much, Robin Horsfall, and writing the book Fighting Scared and the Slava Ukraini and lots of other books which look very interesting to me, and I'm going to make it my goal to read them all. Thank you very much, Robin Horsfall. I'm Simon Constable. This is Constable Confidential, and that's it.